Welcome to Season 3 of One Day You'll Thank Me,
a podcast for smart parents.
I'm Dr. Tara Egan.
And I'm not a Dr. Anna.
I'm a mom, a therapist, and an author.
And I'm a daughter and a kick-ass high school student.
Each week, we'll discuss a different parenting topic.
And we'll interview some fantastic guest experts.
We'll leave you with practical tips and information.
Plus, you'll get the perspective of a teen.
Stay tuned, everyone.
Boom.
Hello, my name is Dr. Tara Egan. Welcome back to One Day You'll Thank Me.
Yeah, hi everyone. I'm Anna, the co-host, and today we have a great episode lined up for everyone.
Yeah, I've been wanting to do this episode for a while, and I wanted to find the just right person to be able to talk about this topic, because I think there's a lot of misinformation out there, and you'll hear from our guest about ways to think about this topic, because there's a lot of tendency to talk about this topic in a really casual way in our world. And so I wanted to bring in the big guns as far as us thinking about it in a more research-based, evidence-based way so that we could just get informed. So I'm going to go ahead. I'm going to introduce our guest. Her name is Bretta Collins, and she is a licensed marriage and family therapist. Her practice is called Dilworth Counseling. This is located in Charlotte, North Carolina. She's Gottman Level 3 trained and has received extensive training in emotionally focused therapy, which is also called EFT, both of which are research-based couple therapies. She's also received training in mindfulness-based stress reduction, and her specialty areas include couples therapy and men in therapy. So today, she's here to talk about narcissistic personality traits and how they impact our relationships. As most of you know, I work with co-parents who are going through high-conflict divorce, and by the time I'm involved, they're nearly always separated or divorced. Whereas Bretta often works with these couples prior to separation or divorce, and so she has tremendous insight about intimate partner abuse, divorcing a spouse who's high conflict, and generally can tell us more about this personality disorder. So, Bretta, thank you for being with us today.
Hi, thank you so much for having me. Unfortunately or fortunately, this is a topic I've become extremely passionate about.
Well, I really am interested in hearing a little bit about how you got into this field. You know, I've wanted specifically to do an episode about narcissistic personality disorder, and I know you're the person here in Charlotte to talk to, but I can't help but wonder, like, what led you to being so passionate about this specialty area?
It's interesting, right? I never thought this would be my specialty area. It found me. I saw persistently and consistently these traits in relationships that were getting in the way. I saw the result of what these traits were doing to the partner within the relationship. And I saw some people really eager to change some of their behavior. And I saw others unable or unwilling to even work towards change. And so it just kind of found me.
It takes a lot of patience, and I think a lot of confidence or like self-possession to be able to be in an interaction with somebody with NPD or NPD traits and not get a little lost in that conversation, because this is a person who's skilled at manipulation. So I commend you for being able to do that. I think I'm pretty good at it too. And it's my skills are developing it the longer I do this work. But I find that to be something I have to give myself a lot of really direct self-talk, a lot of support from mentors and supervisors to make sure I can stay in a space that's also healthy for me.
Absolutely. And talking to peers, supervisors, people who have worked in this field longer than I have and are even more familiar with some of these personality traits is good, because it also allows me to maintain empathy for people who can be extraordinarily difficult to work with, to see how they behave in their relationships with their partners as parents. And so for me, a lot of the work that I need to do and continue to do is just to continue to check in to make sure that I'm maintaining the empathy level that I need to be successful with these people.
Do you know anybody in real life, like not a therapy client, who has narcissistic personality disorder?
Absolutely. And what's really interesting is, and what I have found through my research and the training that I've done and in my own life, if you have one highly narcissistic person in your life, most likely have more than one. There's an attraction between a highly narcissistic person and a more empathetic person, and they just kind of travel together.
Well, that's depressing.
Until you realize it and start making changes.
Until right? You break the cycle.
Exactly.
So my question for you, and I know this is kind of deterring a bit from what we talked about, but is somebody who has narcissistic personality disorder, is it something like you either have or you don't, or is it something where it's more like a spectrum where somebody can have some traits or they can have a sprinkle of it, but they're not like a full-blown?
Absolutely.
Okay.
We all have narcissistic traits. Healthy narcissism, right? Being proud of our accomplishments, try new things. Those things could potentially be coded in our world of coding behavior as narcissistic. So narcissistic traits are found in all of us. And that is also what's so interesting that I see people who come in and wonder, am I the narcissist in this relationship? You know, they're resonating with some of these traits, but they're not a narcissist by feature of even asking that question. But yes, narcissism is a spectrum. And so we can have highly narcissistic traits in an individual. That person is not going to qualify for a diagnosis of narcissistic personality disorder. That is so important to remember. And it's one of the things, and I'm sure you see this, people will say, you know, oh, my ex is narcissistic, my mother is narcissistic, or, you know, whoever the person is that they're talking about. And yes, they have some narcissistic traits for sure, and some more unhealthy ones, or maybe stronger unhealthy ones than another person, but they still don't qualify for the diagnosis of narcissistic personality disorder.
Okay. So I guess that leads to a question of what are the characteristics of a person who could appropriately be diagnosed with narcissistic personality disorder?
So in our field, right, we have this book that tells us in order for a person to qualify for this diagnosis, this many traits needs to be met. And they're pretty technical. So I've kind of broken them down to a little bit more of a lay level understanding. And this is kind of what I'm looking for. And some of these things will probably be familiar to your listeners, right? But the first thing I think that's important to understand about narcissism, it's a self-esteem regulation disorder. So this is a person with very, very, very low self-esteem. And so many of the traits that we see or the behaviors that we see are triggered through this lack of self-esteem. And one of the things that we're always looking for is this whole object relations. And what this means is, are we able to see myself and others in a stable and integrated way that acknowledges both good and bad traits? So it's not black and white, right? You're not all good. You're not all bad. You're not the best. You're not the worst. A narcissistic lens has a really hard time being in both of those cognitive spaces at the same time. I love this person, even though she really hurt my feelings. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Okay. So that's one of the first things I'm looking for. More black or white thinking, gray area. A lot, if not all, people who would qualify for a narcissistic personality disorder are highly status conscious. And so this is, I need to get invited to this party because all the people that are important in town are going to be there. I need to belong to this club because that's where all the important people go. So there's a status consciousness. I see that a lot in my practice. And that's, you know, is that narcissism normal for the culture that we're living in, or is it pathological? And that's hard sometimes to tell. Hypersensitivity to slights. This is a person who has a very hard time hearing any negative feedback, feeling very criticized, perceiving criticism when there is none. And so you can see how this can start to get in the way of interpersonal relationships, right? Or in working relationships.
Mm-hmm.
this person also is going to display disproportionate anger, a much higher reaction than most people would give. Big reaction to minor things. So when I see someone having a really hard time regulating anger responses, you know, I'm not automatically thinking, oh, are you a narcissist? Do you qualify for that? It's just something that I'm paying attention.
It's like a warning sign or a risk factor.
Yes, okay. For sure. Extreme language. These are people who are showing that object relations that we just spoke about. People are perfect or special or the best or the worst. They're the ugliest. They're the meanest. There's just this extreme language that you'll hear them use a lot. And they also have real cruel descriptions of people. Why in the world would that woman wear that dress with that body? That type of really just cruel description. And a lot of that is driven by their own lack of self-esteem. This also is someone who has very, very low empathy. So the experience of empathy, caring about another's emotional experience and their feelings as equally as important as your own. So their sensitivity seems to run in one direction. They're extraordinarily sensitive to their own feelings being hurt or criticism, but they're not sensitive in the other direction towards others.
Sort of like a what about me?
Yes. We are looking at people who do not apologize. They're unable or unwilling to apologize and admit mistakes.
Okay. I'm taking notes.
We're also looking at grandiosity. So this is someone who believes themselves to be more capable, better than another, smarter than. This is a person who would say, I don't know why my boss has that job. I should have that job. I could run circles around her and I would be so much better. Maybe they would, right? But they really, really believe that on that exterior. Because again, what we're talking about is someone who lacks self-esteem on the interior. So this grandiosity on the outside doesn't genuinely reflect what's going on the inside.
What a confusing place to be in. To be so riddled with insecurity and have such a fragile sense of self, but then be always presenting yourself as being confident and bombastic and, you know, coming across as feeling like maybe rules don't apply to you.
Yeah.
Or just being, like you said, some of that cruel language. I mean, that speaks to me in that you do hear people will say something, well, look at that fat pig.
Yeah.
And it's like, you don't even know this person, you know? Yeah. And like, this is where your mind went.
Yeah. It's a really sad lens from which to view the world, in my opinion. And that is how I'm able to maintain the empathy, because I think that's a really difficult and hard way to live. And we see that they are unable to maintain intimate relationships. And so as someone who believes, you know, we're wired for attachment and connection, to see someone lacking ability for that is really sad. But then the way they behave sometimes is really hard to be empathetic towards the behavior and the hurting of another. It's just a really complicated process. You know, the favorite client is one who has some of these traits, but really wants to work on becoming more empathetic, understanding how to take negative feedback, understanding how to think about his or her impact on another person, having more realistic thoughts about self. So those people who are motivated to do that absolutely have the capability to change that.
I imagine that there's a lot of these individuals, though, who aren't seeking therapy.
No.
And so they might go through another failed relationship, or maybe they're estranged from their children, or maybe they've been fired from another job, and it's everybody else's fault. You know, they don't get me. They're, you know, beneath me. And so there's probably some individuals who have a higher level or higher degree of these traits and really stay in a place of pain and dysfunction for a really long time.
Absolutely. And, you know, this is the person in my practice who may come in and say, like, their partner needs to change. Everything is the partner's fault. And so as a couples counselor, the thing I'm always really interested in is, you know, what is your participation in y'all getting to the place where you're needing couples counseling? What are your things that you're doing in this relationship that aren't working? What is your area of self-improvement, or what would you like to work on in yourself? And, you know, most couples, both of them are able to say, I get angry, or I shut down, or I drink too much, or whatever the thing is, right? A more narcissistic person is unable to name anything that they've done to contribute to where they are in their relationship. It is all their partner's fault.
Okay. And so I imagine during times where there's, like for me, as a clinician who's working with parents, and so these are parents who've gone through a divorce, they now have an ex-partner, and now they're trying to cultivate a new life with their child or children. So they have two separate homes, and then we see that child is showing pushback when it comes to how they're this particular parent with these narcissistic traits interacts with them. And so here I am, you know, as a therapist working with the kids, teaching them how to be good communicators, how to express their feelings in an appropriate way, how to advocate for themselves. And then you hear the response of the parent who might be in that place of unhealthy narcissistic traits, and they become the less capable person in the relationship. So now we have, let's say, a 14-year-old girl who has maybe a really empathic, caring mother and has adopted appropriate degrees of empathy. And then they have, let's say, a dad who does not have those skills and cannot participate in the counseling relationship to the same degree that this teenage girl is. And so then my job is like, okay, well, you know, we have to recognize what it is here. And it changes how we approach, or how I approach, intervention with that parent and child, because the parent really is incapable and unwilling to be in a space of reflection.
I think it might be really helpful for a lot of people to remember so much of a truly highly narcissistic personality disordered or high traits in narcissism, their behavior isn't intentional malice. It's patterned behavior. It's as natural as kind of blinking your eyes, right? It is the patterned behavior that they just continue to play out over and over again. And when I share that with my clients, there tends to be some relief in knowing this isn't purposeful. This isn't designed purposefully to punish me or hurt me. It is truly a person who doesn't have capability and something that seems so natural to the other person.
I think that where I see relief, like you said, is when they recognize it's also just not personal. It's not like if that kid was a better daughter, your dad wouldn't be doing this. This is his MO. This is his style of communicating. It's been probably throughout his life. And it's not based on your worth as a person that you have this interaction. So I find that teenagers, especially when they start to get an understanding of that, that it's not personal. And it's not because they're bad or don't deserve to be treated well, that they really can kind of free themselves from the shackles of that relationship.
And it's so interesting because really in that age, that adolescent teen age, it developmentally, it's appropriate for them to be a little more narcissistic, right? So then for your work to teach them not to take everything so personally, when that developmentally is where they are really naturally in our process, how relieving for them to have an adult to share that. This is not about you. There's nothing you can do to change the behavior of your adult parent. You know, the thing about parenting and co-parenting or parallel parenting or whatever the process is going to be, it's hard. It's hard. It's hard on the kids. It's hard on the, you know, less disordered spouse or ex-spouse. It is a really hard thing. And so when people ask me, is this going to be really hard? I am really honest. Yes, it is. It is. And there's, again, some predictable patterns in that divorce process. We're likely going to have more than one attorney involved, and we likely need a parenting coordinator. And, you know, we likely need a therapist to help navigate this process for your kids and for your family. We need a super tight custody agreement. I mean, there's not a lot of flexibility that can be given in that process. So definitely the separation and divorce narcissistic relationship, especially involving kids, it's going to be hard.
Yeah. Anna, what are you thinking when you hear all this?
My head is like, I don't know. It's kind of spinning about like all this information just coming at me at once. But I don't know. It just seems really hard on everyone. I mean, it must be exhausting. Like your clients must, you know, have a hard time going through all of this. I don't know. It just, what exactly do you do to like, how do you start your treatment to like make things better?
I bet your head is spinning. My head gets spinning when we think about all this too. How do we start the process to help make things better? Luckily, your mom is one of the people who really is invaluable in that process to make things better. Unfortunately, if in my office, we can't get the relationship to feel more equal and more loving and more connected and healthier, then generally my work is done with them. That's when they decide that they need to separate and divorce.
They get divorced.
Yeah. So I'm there to help decipher, is this a relationship that can be saved? Are these two individuals who want to be healthy together and grow together? And if the answer is no, then they generally move on and work with someone like your mom who can help them in that process. So I think she's the one who starts to make things feel better. They generally don't leave my office feeling better if that's the case.
But for me, you know, to have you bring the parents, especially the healthier parent, to the place where they can feel comfortable and like give themselves permission to leave this relationship, I think is immeasurable, because then when they come to me and we have to start structuring, you know, boundaries, and we have to think of a custody agreement that, you know, is super tight and doesn't have the flexibility, and having them understand, you know, where they have control and where they don't, I'm not dealing with the parent who is still like, but maybe we can work it out, or, you know, maybe he was cruel because somehow I deserved it, or maybe if I just did this other thing one more time, it would go better. Like, we're not in that space anymore. And you helped them get to that space. And now we can be really forward moving as far as them building a new life, structuring their relationship with their now ex in a healthier way. And then we can do the work of supporting the kids. And so, you got the hard work, lady, not me.
You know, I love working with the individuals who are recovering a relationship with a really highly narcissistic person. I mean, you said it, when they're healthy enough to understand there's nothing that they could have done differently or better, they're not all to blame. They do deserve better treatment, more love, more connection. They are capable of creating boundaries. You know, the damage of a long-term relationship with someone who's highly narcissistic, you know, it has a lot of features of like PTSD, a post-traumatic stress disorder, where we're seeing anxiety, hypervigilance, trouble sleeping. It really creates a hurt to a person's nervous system.
Yeah, they can be in a place of panic all the time. Mm-hmm. And then if they're going through a divorce, you know, the biggest, and you have children, one of the biggest way you can hurt that person is to screw around with their custody or their ability to provide for their kids financially. So oftentimes with these individuals with narcissistic traits, and my knowledge base tells me that men are more likely to be diagnosed with this than women.
Yes, that's true through research. I mean, that's, yes. So okay. Men, if we were looking at like 6% of our culture having the traits that would qualify for a true diagnosis.
Okay.
And I think we're looking at almost like 2-to-1 men to women. So it's definitely more prevalent among men. But I do always caution people, like, women do this too. And because sometimes our lens is like, well, maybe it's the man. I've got to be really open to seeing that women also have these traits and this disorder. But it can be missed just based on the fact that we're kind of, our lens tends to focus in on the male.
Well, and I wanted to clarify that because I keep referring back to it as being dads. So I just wanted to tell our audience, like, I'm not just saying that because I'm biased against men or something,
right.
But it is actually more of a tendency in men. And I think that with some women who are feeling threatened by their ex threatening to take custody of the kids, you know, lying about their ex-wife, you know, really having aspects of cruelty and sort of a vengeance attitude towards their ex, you know, and these are people who will stay in a place of anger for years, you know, where they're sending a text and it's been 3 years, maybe they're even remarried and they're just like, you effing B word. I'm so glad I don't have to see your ugly face every morning. And like, this is like a daily text for them to send to their ex and you're 3 years out. And it's like, oh my goodness, this woman, this is her life because she's got this tie with the kids. And that ex might have gone to extraordinary lengths to make sure that they have as much custody as possible. And really sometimes just to sort of torment the mother.
Yeah. You know, I'm sure you use this term. It's using their children as pawns, mm-hmm. right?
As weapons.
So they're not treating them and honoring them as like these beautiful humans that they are. They're using them to punish the other partner. And, you know, part of the unfortunate reality of someone with this disorder is the keeping the partner off kilter and upset is just part of how they gain energy. It's part of, it's almost like a feeding pattern. I think of it as like emotional vampirism. Like they're sucking this energy out of their partner all those years later. And, you know, with, you know, part of that work for the other partner is those boundaries and becoming strong enough and clear enough that even though I'm still getting texts 3 years later, like this is all his stuff. This has nothing to do with me. I can't respond to this. I cannot give the emotional energy to this. I have to hold my emotional energy for myself. But yeah, those are the people that 15 years later can't sit, you know, at this same side of the church at a child's wedding. I mean, that, you know, when we start looking at that, then it's like we think of narcissists and their behavior as having a goal. Is it to mine that emotional energy? Is it to feel some level of control? Is it to be punishing? You know, what is the goal in that? When we start bordering into like sociopathy, the goal is to hurt, mm-hmm. right? So usually the narcissist's goal isn't to punish and hurt. There's some other motivation there. When our goal becomes to punish and hurt, we start to look even into like malignant narcissism or sociopathy.
Okay. That's good to discriminate between that. Now, when I was doing my research on you and making sure that I was well-versed in what you do, I came across a Facebook post that you had written in June of 2020, and it resonated with me, and I'm going to read it. You wrote, "The narcissistic dance. It is actually a very simple and predictable cycle of events. They hurt you, but because they lack emotional empathy, they don't care. You care. You complain. Then they feel attacked and criticized by you. To protect their very fragile self-esteem, they attack your self-esteem. The goal is to hurt you badly enough that you do not dare rebuke them again, never acknowledging your feelings or their behavior, never apologizing for their wrongdoing." I thought that was a great description. It's dark, though, you know?
I know. That's really deep.
Imagine being the partner or the child of that dance, dancing that dance with somebody.
So this is a person who probably does a lot of gaslighting of their partner or their children, where they can make them question their recollection of events. They can spin the facts of a situation and get everything all twisted, and they can make that person doubt that their feelings are real or justified. And I find that to be a very big barrier to kids and parents being able to get to a place of peace, because they've been told their whole life that they're wrong and they're bad and you didn't interpret that the right way and you're just being sensitive and you make a big deal over everything. You're just like your mother, you know, whatever the phrasing is that comes to mind, and that, you know, seeps into their understanding of themselves. And so we have to do a lot of work for them to be able to recognize that.
And, you know, the problem with gaslighting, one of the problems with gaslighting is it causes a person to kind of second guess themselves and not listen to their intuition or kind of that inner voice that we have. And so then, you know, when you can't trust yourself, the world gets really, really scary. For kids, the thing that I talk to, you know, my clients about, again, they're not quite in the place of what you're doing with them yet, is we can't gaslight our kids. Mm-hmm. So if they say like, "Daddy is so mean to you when you make mistakes," And the mom wants to say, no, oh, honey, he's just had a bad day, mm-hmm. right? Just to kind of make everybody feel better. And the truth is, he is really mean to you when you make mistakes. And when you say, oh, no, no, it's okay, he just had a bad day, we're gaslighting our kids when we do stuff like that.
I always remind parents to not say, well, your dad loves you. Because whether or not dad loves them in the capacity he can, he is not exhibiting loving behavior. So when you are saying, but he loves you so much, you're defining love as something that is really dysfunctional and unhealthy. You know, I always tell parents, like, you know what? Some parents don't love their kids. Like, as awful as that seems, mm-hmm. they either just don't love them or they're not able to exhibit loving behavior regardless. Like, don't tell your kids that this is what love looks like, because that is not what we want their understanding of it to be.
Absolutely. And it's certainly not what we want them to partner up with one day.
Mm-hmm. So give me your input on two things. So one is, do you see that there's certain careers that narcissists gravitate toward? The second question I have is, what causes narcissists to become narcissists? Do we know?
You know, it's become too much of a research topic for me. I'm always reading and trying to understand, because I feel like if we could understand how it occurs, then maybe we stand a shot at helping some of the behaviors. But unfortunately, because it is brain development, you know, we do the majority of our brain development between 0 and 3 and 0 and 7. And so these are really patterned brain development. If we were to look at an MRI, you could see the difference in the brain. What causes it? There's believed to be a hereditary or genetic component to it. And like most things, if we have maybe a slight predisposition to a disorder, and then our family situation is ripe to develop it, right? So just because we have the predisposition doesn't mean like, oh, your mom was a narcissist, so you're going to be a narcissist. That's not the case. But you might have a genetic predisposition. But then you get put into a family life where there's extraordinarily difficult communication, trauma, not emotionally attuned to children. You know, those things start to change how our brains are developing. Trauma is a big one. It's a big one for a lot of disorders. We tend to think of trauma as, you know, child abuse or sexual abuse. Long-term lack of emotional attunement and connection is significant trauma. It's hard to name that because as kids, you know, people don't have a recollection of what that would look like or feel like. We also know that boundaryless families, overdoting, over kind of that parent who believes their child can do no wrong is absolutely perfect. We've got this kid on a pedestal, never makes mistakes. So that can also play into it, but there's not a formula for like this plus this equals this.
Well, I ask that because I always want my kids, when they meet somebody who could be a potential partner, to look at their risk factors. And I know that's like a very therapy thing to think. But, you know, like if you could wave a magic wand and have your kid be able to recognize like, oh, goodness, you know, this is somebody I'm interested in romantically, but they're coming from a family that has a lot of addiction issues, or, you know, there is a lot of estrangement, or there's been a lot of exposure to trauma. Like, you're going to have, I think, going to have to be pretty vigilant in that relationship to make sure that it's going down a path of health when there's some variables there that are strong indicators that it may not.
Absolutely.
So
the thing about the early part of a relationship with someone who's highly narcissistic is it tends to move really fast. So my dating advice for my kids and my clients, it's like slow and steady does win the race. Those relationships tend to move very fast and they tend to feel like too good to be true. These are like soulmates on the second date. And so, you know, when something feels like it's too good to be true, a lot of times it is. So those are kind of the things that I talk to my own kids about. And I definitely talk to my clients about the background. You know, the unfortunate reality is none of us get to choose our parents. None of us get to choose what our house feels like as children. But if you're with someone who's highly narcissistic, I mean, once you start giving some feedback of like, when this happens, it hurts my feelings, and you see this enormous reaction that feels completely out of line with what you've just shared, you know, narcissistic or not, it's toxic. It's not healthy. So for sure, like, let's teach our kids and people to look at backgrounds, and then just to really pay attention to what's being shown to you versus what you wish was being shown to you, or what you know is, he once was able to do this, so I bet he'll be like this again. I mean, we have to really pay attention to what people are showing us.
Well, when I first interact with clients, when they call me up and they say, I'm going through this really tough divorce and I want support for myself and my kids, guaranteed the word narcissistic is going to come out of their mouth. And so for me as a clinician, you know, I have to say, or be able to reflect on, okay, is this true NPD? Or is this a phrase that somebody said to this parent and they really honestly don't know what it is they're saying? Or is this a really unbecoming side of this process, right? Like, I think when parents start going through the process of custody and all of that, like, the worst versions of themselves are there. So how do our listeners determine the difference between somebody who truly is narcissistic versus somebody who maybe they're toxic, maybe they're unhealthy, maybe they're going through a really grief-stricken stage of this divorce and they are at their worst version of themselves? Like, how do we sort that out?
The first thing I wonder is, like, what's important about sorting that out, right? If the behavior is the same, if this is someone whose anger is disproportionate to what's going on, if this is someone who is punishing, who cannot take negative feedback, who is controlling, who is, you know, willing to spend $1 million not to have to give somebody $500,000. Like, if we're starting to see those types of behavior, would it be helpful for the person to know qualifies for narcissistic personality disorder? Or would it be helpful for the person to know these are toxic, dangerous traits? And because you were involved in this toxic relationship, it's become your kind of homeostatic normal, and you're likely going to be drawn to the same type of personality again, unless you do something to help yourself. I mean, I think, like, part of it is drawing it back to, like, what can I control here? And I can only control making sure I don't get myself involved in a relationship with someone like this again, that I don't poke the bear, that I understand the trigger points for this person. And what is my role here? Because even in a really narcissistic relationship, right? Like, we have a role, we stay, we do the dance, we ended up in these relationships for some reason. And for most people, they ignored a whole lot of red flags to get themselves into that relationship. So, you know, part of me is like, the work is on the person who was the partner, because the highly narcissistic person most likely isn't going to do any work. The benefit could be explains an awful lot when you start reading what being in a relationship with a highly narcissistic person feels like, and you realize you're not alone, that this is like a thing that can help the person not take it so personally, but really for them to decide, like, this person is full-blown NPD versus very highly narcissistic traits. They already know the answer. They probably do have highly narcissistic traits. And the angrier they become and the more control they lose, the more escalated they are going to become. None of us can diagnose somebody with NPD, right? Like, that isn't working with.
Yeah, that's not our client. As much as we'd like to say, like, Donald Trump is.
Right. They're not ours. They're not in my office. I do think, and it's something I recommend with my clients, for them to let their attorneys know that their belief is that their partner has some really high narcissistic tendencies and traits, because it helps their attorney understand what they're likely going to be dealing with. And they know, right? They see it. So they do know.
I think that it can be helpful for that type of communication to happen between client and lawyer. But I tell clients, like, if you bring up concrete examples of narcissistic behavior and your lawyer is dismissive, mm-hmm. or truly doesn't seem to understand it, you know, really think about whether or not this lawyer is going to be a good advocate for you. Because if they're like, oh, here's another lady complaining that her ex is narcissist because he wants some custody and cheated on her 10 times, then, you know, blah, blah, blah. Like, you know, they need to be able to, as lawyers, parse out, you know, what these serious toxic behaviors, you know, what the impact is on their client, on their client's ability to come out of the divorce in a good position, like emotionally, financially, whether or not their safety is protected, you know, what the custody situation is. So I have come across lawyers who are very dismissive. And as soon as a woman says that phrase, they're already rolling their eyes. And then I have others who tune right in and really take that to heart and ask really discerning questions.
And I totally agree. And I've had clients with the same experience, attorneys who immediately understand that this is going to be a more complex situation and do understand if my client is financially vulnerable, that that's a very different situation with a more highly narcissistic personality who does like control. They understand we need to plan what this is going to look like before you actually completely exit this relationship. And they understand that they may very well end up in some type of litigation versus a mediation. And the attorneys that have kind of scoffed off the highly narcissistic patterns of some of the clients, right, that does them such a disservice. Because again, it's like that lack of validation of their experience that they've received in their relationship for all these years.
I feel like it can really perpetuate the abusive dynamic. So mm-hmm. if you're working with a lawyer or a guardian ad litem or a parent coordinator or even certain judges, and they are dismissive of that, you know, it can be so, so damaging. So I think that parents who are in the process of choosing a lawyer, you know, they need to be really mindful. There's some lawyers who really want to avoid going to court. And they will focus on mediation and they'll have you go to mediation 10 different times. Well, when you're in that circumstance with the narcissist, you're spending a lot of money, probably not getting anywhere because mediation requires both parties to be cooperative and compromising. And so it's just important. So that's something that I think you and I probably have the ability to support parents in that process of thinking about a lawyer they might be a good fit with, because it's really influential on how that divorce goes.
Well, you know, there's lots of research around who is the most abusive in a family court. It's a highly narcissistic individual. These are the ones who are going back to court, switching attorneys, requiring documents that they don't need, just really burning up resources. And so if you don't have an attorney who's prepared for that or has done that before or understands what that's going to entail, you know, it can be detrimental to the outcome of the final decree. So absolutely, I'm really big on some attorneys that are very, very good at working with a partner in a narcissistic relationship. And I just appreciate so much the work and support that they're able to give these clients.
So let's talk about, and probably we can have this discussion together, what do we see as far as how children are impacted? What do we see are the consequences for the children of having a parent with NPD?
I'm seeing a lot of anxiety in that child because, again, if we think about the intuitive nature of kids, right, their intuition is so strong. It doesn't feel right, but they don't have the words or understanding of what is going on here that feels so off. That's one of the things that I see is lots of anxiety. I also see, you know, and I hear a lot of, again, I'm going to go with women in my office, so fearful of like the Disney dad. You know, their partner is making a lot of money. It's going to be much more financially secure after the divorce is over. And so they get to have just tons of fun and tons of material things provided for them by this person. And then the other person is doing all this emotional heavy lifting and trying to teach right from wrong and trying to schedule sports and schools and all the things. And that person becomes a little more stressed out and may not feel that they're giving enough love, time, and attention to the child. And they see their child getting all this fun, exciting, awesome stuff at the other parent's house. And the kids themselves, right? They're kids. Who doesn't want to go to Disney World? Who doesn't want, you know, a pair of $200 new shoes or whatever the thing is? And so it's confusing for the kid, right? Like, I get all this stuff over here at this house, my mom's making me follow all the rules, making me do all my homework, making me make my own lunch for school. And it can get really confusing. I'm like, I'm happier over here because it's easier, but I am more emotionally in tune to this person over here. So I think that there's just a lot of like cognitive dissonance and anxiety and confusion in that kid.
And if the parent, the narcissistic parent, is speaking very ill of the other parent, you know, your mom, you know, she's always so uptight and, you know, she's just kind of a bitch and, you know, she's just making your life harder for no reason. Why is she always on your back? You're such a good kid. You don't do anything wrong.
Right.
You know, you got to have some freedom or whatever they say. And then that kid can end up, I see sometimes kids will show a lot of anger and resentment towards the stable parent because they're literally being taught to, but then also in that teenager, let's focus on fun things. I want to see my friends. I want to have unlimited technology, whatever it is. That's just what feels good.
Right. No boundaries, right? Like, of course. I mean, we know children and adolescents and teens require structure and boundaries, that they're going to buck against them, right? That's the dance between the mom and dad of a healthy family and their teenagers is, here's the boundaries, but I don't like boundaries, but you need boundaries. Then they have a parent that's not giving that, right? No resistance. So it's really appropriate and developmentally normal that the kid would kind of think it's more fun over here.
I do see a lot of kids come around later, you know, where there's something where they do something that displeases the narcissistic parent. They want to go to a college their dad doesn't approve of. They're gay. They bring home a partner that doesn't have the same background that parent would have picked for their child. They do something that is deemed controversial. And then that child is then the victim of like a complete shutdown of acceptance from the narcissistic parent, where they went from being like, honey, I would do anything for you and I just want you to be happy, to you're nothing to me.
Yeah, that's that object permanence, right? I love you so much. Oh, you've disappointed me. I don't love you anymore. It can be, it's the devaluing. It's just that complete kind of cut off. Absolutely. And, you know, interestingly, and I'm sure you see this, one of the really triggering events for a narcissistic parent is when kids start to maintain and gain some independence. When all of a sudden, like, no, I don't want to do that with you. I want to go out to dinner with my friends. Mm-hmm. Those types of things can feel like rejecting to a highly narcissistic person. And that is a triggering event. And just the normal development of a kid growing into a more independent person. And so I think, you know, for the healthier parent, it's important to remember those triggers, right? A child deciding they want to spend Christmas at their mom's house versus their dad's house, that can feel really rejecting and cause lots of kind of triggered behavior from the more narcissistic parent. And then how does that play out for the child, right? Like, do I become the peacekeeper? Do I become the rebel? Do I, you know, how am I going to be able to manage myself in a way that this is manageable for me? And what you said about the talking about the other parent, I mean, I wrote some notes down before we met. I mean, if the healthier parent, it is just none of her business what's being said about her.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. We, Anna and I have had that conversation, you know, just generally of like, if there's ever a time where somebody says something negative about me at the other house, like, I actually don't need to know. Like, if you have a question as the child, like, oh, is this right? Or, you know, I always want you to ask, but like, you don't need to report anything to me. Like, that's not something I need to know or have any moment of stress over. And as a kid, I don't want you to have a stressful moment over how I'm going to respond. You know, like, I know who I am and I know I make good decisions and you know who I am and you know I make good decisions. And so we're just going to go off that.
Right. And, you know, it can become almost persistent in that desire to like mine for information of what's going on at the other parent's house. And there's just not much healthy that's going to come from that, unless we're concerned about, you know, true abuse that's dangerous to the child. But I am always telling people, it's not your child's job to deliver messages to or from. Do not put them in the middle. Mm-hmm. And don't disparage the other parent. You've got friends, maybe a therapist, who a pastor, whoever it is that you can kind of talk and vent to, but it's not your child.
Yeah, absolutely. One of the final questions I want to ask you, Bretta, is I've become more aware recently that the term narcissistic abuse is a dangerous term because it's often used as a way to make the term domestic violence more palatable. And it permits abusers to avoid responsibility because they're viewed as sick or it's outside of their control. Tell me your perspective about this.
So when I think of the term narcissistic abuse, that is a complete and totally separate term that does not incorporate domestic violence. That incorporates the relational damage done and the kind of complex trauma done to the partner in the relationship. So when I think of narcissistic abuse, I'm thinking more of like psychological and emotional abuse. It isn't a DSM term. Our kind of guiding diagnostic criteria does not recognize that as a real thing. For me, it's very real. I see it. I see it in my clients. A lot of times can see when a couple comes to me that one of them is a victim to this narcissistic abuse going on in their relationship. Domestic violence can happen in a narcissistic relationship, but it happens in a lot of relationships where clearly somebody's not healthy or both of them aren't healthy, but it has nothing to do with narcissism. I don't think there's any excuse for domestic violence. I think, you know, we know anger management and there's lots and lots of ways that people can get help for that inability to emotionally regulate. But from my lens, those things are completely and totally separate. I think the concern is, like you said, a free pass. I have a disorder, therefore I can't help it. Even a highly narcissistic person can control physical violence with the right help. So to me, those are very different. I follow to see what the discussion is looking like. And, you know, like everything else right now, there's two sides to it. It's kind of polarizing right now. And again, for me, narcissistic abuse is really the gaslighting, deflection, the projection, all of the things that cause a person to think either something is wrong with them or they're going crazy because they can't trust their own eyes and feelings any longer. That's kind of when I hear and think of narcissistic abuse, that's what I'm looking at.
Okay.
Does that make sense?
It does. It does. I think I always just want to make sure that for those of us out there who've ever experienced this, you know, I have been the victim of it, that I think it's great to understand it's not personal, that it's part of a pattern of behavior, that it's brain-based. But I also think it's important for people to recognize, like, even though those things are true, it's not okay. You're not in a safe situation. It's important to disengage, to set those boundaries, to want more for yourself, to make sure you're not repeating that pattern over and over with different relationships. And you can both be in a space of compassion towards those individuals, but also recognize it's not your responsibility to be there by their side and have it impact your life.
The reality is none of us have the power to fix or change a person, right? And so I hear so many people that felt like they could just love this person enough, they could just give enough, do enough, change enough, that things would get better. And I always laugh and say, that's kind of narcissistic, right? To think we have that much power. We have no control over other people. We only have control over ourselves.
Now, is there any resources out there that you would recommend for our audience members? Any books or articles or podcasts or websites or anything that you tend to refer to your clients or you found to be a helpful tool yourself in learning more about this?
So this is a non-scientific resource, but it is one that my clients have really resonated with, and I've recommended it to some friends. There is this online discussion forum. It's called Quora, Q-U-O-R-A. And if you look up narcissistic relationships, there are psychologists on there. There's a like world-renowned psychologist on there that I have read a bunch of her work, but there's regular people describing their experience. And again, when I have clients read that and hear exact terms that their partner have said to them. It's like a light bulb moment. And it also, again, it like really normalizes, this is a real thing. I'm not making this up. This was my experience. So I love that. I love the book Rethinking Narcissism.
Now that we're talking about this, I'm going to mention a resource that I find to be really helpful for particularly mothers who are going through a divorce with a high conflict person. And there is, it's on Facebook, and they're also, the person who started it is called One Mom's Battle, and Tina Swithin is the founder of it. And she wrote a book called One Mom's Battle, and she also has a follow-up book. And so she created this community online, and the Facebook group, One Mom's Battle, has a lot of helpful information, people telling their stories, people talking about what individuals in their community are knowledgeable about this and can be supportive. And I know I'm on the list of providers for North Carolina as being like One Mom's Battle friendly. So that is a great resource if you're looking for a lawyer, a therapist, GALs, things like that. And there's some areas of the country, you know, they haven't found allies, but there's some areas where they have. So mm-hmm. that's a great resource just to hear the stories of real people and be getting some pretty solid advice.
Awesome. I wrote that down. I'm always looking for resources to share.
It's pretty hard to read. I mean, I know for me, I have to quiet it on my Facebook sometimes. I kind of pop in and out because, you know, these are women who are really struggling. You know, when you're interacting with somebody long term and it's maybe been years and maybe your kids have really been impacted in a negative way, it's hard to watch those, to read those stories over and over. So sometimes I have to give myself a little break from it, but then I kind of join back in. So it's a good resource.
Just like anything with narcissism, right? Like when we are involved either in reading about it or working with them or having relationships with them, we just have to take such good care of ourselves.
That's really, really important. You're right. Now, is there any final thoughts? I'm trying to be mindful of your time. Is there any final thoughts you want to make sure our audience hears today?
You know, the thing, I guess, that's troubling me lately about this topic, because it's become such a common word, I'm actually seeing an opposite effect of like, not everybody is using it and people are not using it when it is happening in their life relationships, but they don't want to overuse the term. It's kind of like years ago when ADHD kind of really became a forefront issue in our field and people thought it was overused, overdiagnosed. I think that we're probably underdiagnosing it. I think that it is a worthy thing to pay attention to if you, your partner or parent or child or whoever has these traits. I think it's worthy of your time and attention and education. My fear is by our profession saying it's being overused, that we're again like silencing people when they're actually in that type of relationship.
That's so good to hear. Then I can feel more relaxed using that term because... And I know I have a skewed sample, right? I mean, people who are calling me for services aren't doing the run-of-the-mill divorce. You know, they are doing the high-conflict divorce. Yeah. They are much more likely to have interactions with people who have narcissistic personality disorder and probably come from a family where there's a series of people with it. So it's not even just the one person.
Right. You know, I think of divorces as either being sad or mad. Two sad people typically aren't narcissistic.
Yeah, I had one time had somebody say the easiest way for them to get over the grief of their divorce was going into a custody battle with their narcissistic ex. There was no room for sad anymore because they had to use every, you know, resource at their disposal to stay in a space of like toughness and like going to battle. And there just wasn't room for grief at that time, because they had to be on their toes and they had to look behind them and they knew they were being followed by, you know, private investigators. They knew that there was, you know, being picked at financially. They knew that there were, had gotten a therapist at one point and that therapist was getting subpoenaed and, you know, everything about their life was being kind of ripped apart. And so like grieving the loss of their marriage wasn't on their radar anymore.
Yeah, that was a luxury that they were not afforded. It is a truly devastating experience. And it's a hard one. And I think by us, you know, as therapists, I do want to leave people feeling hopeful. And I am a hopeful person, and I do believe in better days for all people. But I think it's important for us to be honest too. It is a hard process.
Well, parents out there, if you're listening, and I hope you are, think about it from the perspective of what support can you get if you're in the process of something like this? You know, there's people like me, there's people like Bretta out there who are here to support you, whether it's therapy, whether it's coaching, whether it's getting you in front of a lawyer who's going to be the right fit for you, whether it's supporting your kids so that they can grow up having a healthy understanding of interpersonal relationships and have healthy self-esteem and problem-solving skills. There's a lot of support that you can get out there. You know, Bretta offers her services through Dilworth Counseling here in Charlotte. I offer my services through Charlotte Parent Coaching, but then I also offer coaching services through my drterryegan.com website. And divorce is a common topic we talk about in this podcast. So, you know, take a look through the list of episodes that we've had over the last, you know, year, over a year now, and pick out those episodes that are going to be relevant for you, because there's just a lot of resources out there to help you with this, because you're not alone. You know, you're not alone in trying to be mindful about the new patterns of behavior that or you know, in relationships you're getting into, as well as supporting your kids. You know, we appreciate you listening. We have new episodes that come out of One Day You'll Thank Me every Wednesday. Anna and I are quite the team here, although she's now entering her junior year and is suddenly getting very busy.
Yeah. Woohoo.
Thank you so much, Bretta, for being with us today.
Well, thank you for having me. It was a joy and a pleasure. And Anna, good luck in your junior year. That's an exciting big year.
Yeah, thank you.
All right. It was great to see you both today.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. Stay tuned for upcoming episodes. Love you, Mom.
Love you too, sweetie.